Welcome to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast. Every 2 weeks, we explore news and issues affecting hunters, anglers, and conservation across the northeastern United States. If you enjoy the content here, be sure to subscribe to our print or digital versions by calling 800-535-5191 or visit our website at outdoornews.com. Now, here's your host and a man who claims he's immune to buck fever, New York Outdoor News editor, Dan Ladd.
This episode of the Great Northeast Podcast is brought to you by the Family Forest Carbon Program, a collaborative initiative brought to you by two nonprofits, the American Forest Foundation and the Nature Conservancy, assisting landowners in improving the health of their land with long-term sustainable forest management practices while providing guaranteed annual income. Learn more at familyforestcarbon.org. Greetings and welcome to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. Happy to be along with you here on what is soon to be the end of August. And boy, that means one thing. I know for some folks, it means the kids are going back to school. But depending on what you follow for a fall schedule, whether you follow the meteorological calendar, which means fall begins September 1st, or of course, the astronomical one, which means we got about another month of summer left. Either way, September 1st is fast approaching, and that means hunting seasons across many states here in the Northeast. I know here in New York on September 1st, that's the opening of the squirrel hunting season. I believe it's the same in Vermont. And, of course, waterfowl, especially Canada goose hunters, those resident geese, the ones that aren't migrating, that season opens up in September in many states. And there's quite a fraternity out there of guys and gals who pursue geese. They like to hunt those geese and enjoy the early hunting seasons. We hope you're getting out, doing a little bit of that, maybe doing something to wrap up your summer. Of course, it's the fair season. As you go to the county fairs and the state fairs, you get to see your friends in the conservation booths. Say hello to them. Again, a lot happening this time of year, and we've got a pretty hot topic to discuss today. We've got Meg Modley with us from the Lake Champlain Basin Program and an avid angler named Ed Skorupski, who's been on this podcast before talking about striped bass fishing. But we're going to talk about the round goby, which has been making its way through New York, through the Mohawk River, the Erie Canal. It's now in the Hudson River, and there's a big concern that it could find its way into Lake Champlain at some point. And that is our topic of discussion, which we'll be tackling when we come back right after this.
Attention hunters, are you ready to take your hunting game to the next level? OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate hunting partner. Stay up to date with the latest hunting trends, gear reviews, and expert tips from seasoned hunters. OutdoorNews.com provides the most comprehensive hunting news to ensure you're always in compliance with local laws. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a beginner, OutdoorNews.com is for you. We're passionate about preserving our hunting heritage and fostering responsible hunting practices. OutdoorNews.com, where hunters become legends.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. We've got two guests with us today to talk about round gobies in the Hudson River and hopefully not Lake Champlain, which is what is the basis of this discussion. And with us, we've got Meg Modley. She is from the Lake Champlain Basin Program. And we've got a well-traversed angler named Ed Skorupski, who wears a lot of hats, and he's been on this podcast before. I want to make you both welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Dan.
Let's start with you. What exactly is the Basin Program? What's your role? Are you affiliated with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or is this something totally separate?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So the Lake Champlain Basin Program was created by an act of Congress back in 1990. We are part of the New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission as our partner, and we are an organization that takes directive from our steering committee, which is made up of representatives from New York, Vermont, and the province of Quebec, because that represents the watershed of Lake Champlain. So we receive federal funding from the Environmental Protection Agency, primarily through the Clean Water Act. We also are able to harness resources from the National Park Service, and from the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, which is really critical because those dollars can be spent north of the border to help us do nutrient reduction and habitat and fish conservation efforts in the Quebec portion of the basin. So we have a long-term management plan called Opportunities for Action, and within it, we have four focus areas on clean water, healthy ecosystems, which is where we focus on all of the aquatic invasive species and habitat and fish issues, and then we have the informed and involved public and thriving communities. So we have a pretty widespread mission on protecting Lake Champlain and working with our partners in Vermont, New York, and Quebec.
And you're out of Grand Isle, Vermont, is that correct?
So our main office is in Grand Isle, Vermont, it's on the Ed Weed Fish Hatchery campus, basically, which is we rent space from the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Nice. And you work out of there regularly?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Ed, you've been with us before talking about striped bass fishing, but this is a whole different critter, so to speak, whole different animal, whole different fish species, invasive species. And I know you've been concerned about this for a long time. And you're also obviously very familiar with both the Hudson River and Lake Champlain as an angler, but also as a volunteer. Tell us a little bit about what you do and why this is important to you.
Well, it's important to me because primarily I fish a lot on Lake Champlain from October through March for salmon and lake trout. I enjoy it very much. I have several friends who do it. I make on average about 15 to 30 trips a year, depending on the weather, which is very iffy during that period of the year. And I see the goby as a serious threat to the trout and salmon in particular, but the rest of the fishery in Lake Champlain also. They're a predator. They're an invasive species. Their reproductive capacity is incredible compared to our native fish, and they quickly displace native fish over a short period of 3 to 4 years, as evidenced in Oneida Lake, where they've been there since, I think, 2014, and now they're the most dominant benthic species in the lake. And we're seeing evidence of that in the lower part of the Hudson River Champlain Canal already from Lock 1 up to Lock 2. So it's a very, very big concern of mine that one of my favorite fisheries will go away. Secondary to that, the goby, which came from the Great Lakes through the Erie Canal into the Hudson, has made its way south on the tidal part of the Hudson all the way to Newburgh or Poughkeepsie, depending on what data you look at. There's a great concern from the standpoint of fisheries there is that over the years, a lot of time has been expended on restoring the herring population. It was in a dip several years ago, and some pretty severe restrictions were put on the taking of herring by the sport fishery group, fishing for stripers in particular, and the herring spawn in the rocks along the shore. You can see them. It's quite spectacular in the spring. That's exactly where the gobies are going to go. So there's a potential threat to the rebounding herring population and consequently the food source for the striper. So I'm concerned for both the estuary fishery and the Lake Champlain fishery. The real problem with the goby is once you've got them, you can't get rid of them. There's no stopping them. There's not a solution.
Are they a species that thrives in various habitats, warm water, cold water, deep water, vegetation? Is there any particular place they don't thrive? I guess that's my question.
I guess the only data I've seen that from the U.S. is that with some testing done with respect to salinity in the lower part of the Hudson. And at some point, I don't remember the exact number, it seems that increased salinity does stem their migration. Outside of that, I'm not aware of anything else that stops their movement except predator fish. Bass apparently love these little critters. Meg, do you know any more?
I would say that, I mean, they're bottom dwellers and they like rocky substrates, and they have been doing quite well in a number of different habitat environments. So, you know, the issue here in looking at Lake Champlain is that we don't know exactly what kind of an impact they would have to Lake Champlain, and we don't want to find out. What we know is the impacts that have been observed in other lakes, as Ed referred to. There are some somewhat alarming studies showing that they are able to sustain salinities and reproduce with higher tolerance to salinity than we had hoped. And the fear there is that they might move out of the Hudson River and around into the Long Island Sound area and infest additional tributaries on the East Coast.
Meg, what do you hear from people up and down both Vermont and New York shores of Lake Champlain? Do you talk with folks in different groups throughout, you know, the entire lake? And I guess that would even go into Canada. Is there a level of concern, or are you the one, you know, saying, hey, folks, wake up, we've got to do something about this?
No, I think it's pretty clear that the three jurisdictions are very concerned about round goby and trying to prevent round goby from moving to Lake Champlain. So the natural resource agencies in Vermont, New York, and Quebec have all harnessed their expertise and their resources and are collaborating together to look at preventing round goby movement towards Lake Champlain. Now, a lot of the anglers on the lake, we have a lot of interactions with folks using Lake Champlain on the boat launches through our watercraft inspection and decontamination program on the New York, Quebec, and Vermont sides of the lake. And it's great that folks are attentive to the issue. And if they think they see something, they're reporting it. Luckily, all the reports to date have been suspicions of round goby have turned out to be our native sculpin that looks very similar to round goby. The difference is round goby have that fused pelvic fin that looks like a suction cup on their belly. That's the invasive round goby. And if that pelvic fin is splayed, it is likely our native sculpin. But the issue here is that we have round goby to our north in Quebec in the St. Lawrence River. And they're trying to move upstream in the Richelieu River towards Lake Champlain. For the listening audience, Lake Champlain flows north into the Richelieu River, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then out to the ocean. But we also have this population of round goby that's moved across the Erie Canal, is now at the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson, and has been detected just below Lock C1 is where we've had fish in hand, but we have a very comprehensive early detection monitoring program. This takes all of the partners. So this involves U.S. Geological Survey. It involves U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the states of New York, the states of Vermont, the Canal Corporation, the Lake Champlain Basin Program. Everybody is out there collecting environmental DNA to see if we can collect any remnants of goby in the water. We're doing trawling and seining and also electrofishing to look for round goby. And so all of these partners come together, and one of the task forces that I helped coordinate is an invasive species rapid response task force. And our two primary issues right now are trying to prevent round goby from moving towards Lake Champlain and paying attention to some recent findings of grass carp, which are different from the silver and big head carp that are threatening the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal in the Great Lakes, but still is a species that has been stocked in the past to control vegetation. And those stocked fish have been fixed. But we are concerned that before regulations went into effect to prevent grass carp from moving, there could be some fertile or gravid fish that could be moving through the system, because they live to be quite old, about 30 years plus for the grass carp.
I'd like to talk more about the eDNA that has been recently found in the Hudson River when we come back right after this.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land in Vermont, Massachusetts, or New York, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
There's a great program available for youth who love to hunt and fish. It's called the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team, and any youth 18 or under can join for free at jrproteam.com. JPT program showcases useful videos and tips to help encourage the next generation to become stronger anglers and hunters. It's a platform to celebrate and inspire those outdoor loving youth. Check out the photos of Outdoor News Junior Pro Team members on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube, and visit our jrproteam.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. We've got Meg Modley with us. She's with the Lake Champlain Basin Program. and a well-traversed angler, Ed Skorupski, who fishes both the Hudson River and Lake Champlain. We've been talking about round goby and actually grass carp too, but getting back to the round goby, folks, we know there was some eDNA discovered in the Hudson River near Loch Sewell, I believe that's around Waterford. And I know, Ed, that's right down in your wheelhouse where you live. But can you shed some light more on eDNA? And I know there's some concern, or there might even be some discrepancy in what caused that, whether it's the actual presence of gobies or not.
Well, I'd be happy to start with the environmental DNA. eDNA is a technology where you collect water from a lake or a river. You collect a certain quantity of water and you put it through a filter. And that collects environmental DNA from the organisms that are in or around or near that collection of water. And that's sent off to a lab and analyzed. And then you match it to known round goby eDNA to see if you can get any hits, any positive connections there. And so eDNA has been used as a little bit of, let's say, an early detection monitoring tool. It tends to be able to pick up the presence of an organism before there are enough of those organisms to be able to catch them physically in hand. So eDNA is viewed as our early detection monitoring tool. We have had a comprehensive eDNA monitoring program in place since we first detected the round goby at the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson River. And again, partners have come together with funding from the Lake Champlain Basin Program, New York State DEC, Canals is getting involved as well as the state agencies in doing this early detection monitoring using eDNA. That is followed up and complemented by the physical sampling, which is trawling and seining and electrofishing. And so in many cases and in other bodies of water, you might often get an environmental DNA detection of an organism anywhere from a few days to a few months or maybe even a year before you're able to catch an organism in hand.
How alarming is the discovery?
So originally when we started environmental DNA monitoring in the Hudson River system, we were able to detect them at the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson Rivers and not at Loch C1 or C2 or further upstream. And it's comprehensive because we want to make sure that we're not missing some separate introduction somewhere else in the system. So we have sampling that spans the entire Champlain Canal, actually goes into Lake Champlain and then north into the Richelieu River and up into Quebec. So when we got the eDNA positive detection right below Loch C1, it took a number of months before we were able to actually catch a fish in hand at that location. The fact that now we have a positive detection of eDNA above Loch C2 is concerning. It means that we need to do more sampling, and it might be an indicator that the goby are moving upstream. But right now, the source of the eDNA that was collected above Loch C2 is not confirmed in the sense that we haven't been able to collect round goby in hand, but we are certain that the eDNA is from round goby. So when we say we don't know what the source is, it could be from a fish that has made its way up there, or it could be from a bird or another organism that has consumed round goby and has excreted that DNA, and we've been able to collect it in a water sample.
Interesting. So there's no physical evidence that they're there, but they could be, or they could be quite close, you know, close enough to be concerning.
That's correct. And, you know, we have many of the partners have provided a lot of input into a TARP plan, which is a threshold action response plan that is managed by New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, as well as NIPA Canals. And it has different response actions that will be taken if a detection is found within the Champlain Canal system. And so since a positive eDNA hit was detected above Loch C2, the Canal Corporation moved immediately into double flushing and scheduled lockings of Loch C3 and 4 in addition to Loch C1 and C2. So those action plan operations that have been identified are being followed based on the data that is being collected.
How comfortable are you with these actions?
Well, you know, we have a very long-term view of how important it is to address aquatic invasive species moving through the Champlain Canal system. So if we can leave just the idea of round goby aside for a moment and think of other organisms that are present in the Hudson and the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway that are not present in Lake Champlain, I can give you a few examples like the quagga mussel, hydrilla, the aquatic invasive plant. These are the snakehead fish. These are other organisms in addition to round goby that are not present in Lake Champlain. And they have a threat of moving through the canal pathway. They can swim, they can be entrained, or they can float. And so there is a and has been a long-term view of looking through the Water Resources Development Act. There is authorization for the Army Corps of Engineers to explore alternatives to prevent all different types of organisms or all different types of taxa from moving through the system. So our long-term goal is to find a solution to implement in the Champlain Canal that would prevent the movement of these aquatic invasive species, but would allow for boat traffic to continue to move through the system. And that might look like some kind of a physical barrier for the organisms that at the point where the two watersheds are connected, the Hudson and the Champlain drainage, that's sort of in the middle of the Champlain Canal between Lock C8 and C9. And maybe a boat lift that would lift recreational watercraft up and over and decontaminate it in whichever directions it is traveling, which would keep the system open and navigable with an added hurdle, if you will, to help prevent invasive species from moving through the system. In the interim, the Canal Corporation and other partners have been looking at what we call interim measures. Is there something that we can do before we can get something implemented to address all different taxa that could prevent round goby from moving through the system? We've looked at, and they have looked at, bubble barriers and screening and electrical deterrents, such as the one that's used at the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal. Those might be able to be layered or implemented ahead of an all taxa approach. But in the interim, the operational changes that can be made on the ground today and in the past have been scheduled locking, which reduces the number of times by which invasive species could move through the lock systems themselves, and the double flushing. And the idea about double flushing the locks is that if there is an invasive species trying to challenge moving through the system, that flushing the lock once would push or flush the species away from the entrance of the lock doors. Then they would close and refill and then open again for the traffic to move through the system, hopefully preventing those invasives from moving through. The efficacy of that is still to be fully really analyzed, but it is something that has been able to be done now. And we are hopeful that it is a positive, you know, deterrent in preventing goby from moving up through the system.
Is it time consuming? I guess from the concern of, say, a boater trying to move through the lock system, does it create an inconvenience for them?
Absolutely. It takes time to flush the lock once and refill it and then open the gates again. So that's a delay in movement through the system. Probably a greater challenge is the delay in waiting for scheduled lockings. The Champlain Canal has operated on a recreational lock-on-demand system up until these deterrent actions have been put in place. So instead of arriving at the lock and having it open when you show up, you would have to wait for a certain time to move through the system.
Okay. That's some interesting information you've been providing for us here, Meg. Good stuff. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more discussion of the round goby in Lake Champlain in Hudson River Champlain Canal right after this.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. We've got Ed Skorupski with us, who is an angler, and he's also part of the Hudson River Estuary Program. I hope I said that correctly. And Med Modley from the Lake Champlain Basin Program. We've been discussing primarily the round goby and the concern we have in this state about it eventually finding its way to Lake Champlain. And what I want to talk about is how it's physically going to get there. I live in Washington County, actually, and the Champlain Canal flows right through my hometown. And I believe we're kind of near what would be the where the basin splits. You know, we're going downstream towards the Atlantic Ocean or going upstream towards Lake Champlain and eventually the St. Lawrence River. So you mentioned Meg C8 and C9. And I know, Ed, you and I have talked in the past about boat traffic on the canal. So let's start there. I mean, I know you mentioned some industrial traffic, and it's probably not now known just how much traffic there is and how this would impact traffic if there was any controls on the lock. So what's your thoughts on that, Ed?
Well, historically, the Champlain Canal was a pretty heavily used commercial entity, primarily for fuel barges going up to Burlington. And that goes back to when I moved to Stillwater, which is C4 in 1982. But from the standpoint of commercial traffic, that has seen a pretty tremendous reduction. Right now, there's a stone aggregate company, Peckham's, I believe, in Fort Edward, that sends aggregate downstream through the locks on a periodic basis. And more recently, the power project, bringing hydropower from Canada down along the Champlain Corridor, is using that as a means by which to transport the equipment and that's being installed. Overall, the commercial uses has dropped tremendously over the last 40 years. It's still heavily used from a recreational standpoint, boaters, water skiers. There's a terrific recreational resource in fisheries there. The fisheries has been closed due to the PCB issues for several decades. And the warm water fishery is really terrific there, particularly the bass fishing. But there's virtually no, and the loopers. We shouldn't forget the loopers, those people who start in the warm climes of Florida, Texas, the Gulf Coast, and come up the East Coast, up through the Hudson Estuary and split either to the west at the Erie Canal or to the north on the Champlain Canal and into Lake Champlain and up to Toronto and then through the St. Lawrence Seaway down to Mississippi and make the loop all over again the following year. Common. Those people are probably one of the bigger user groups outside of the local residents. So there's a fair amount of traffic, but from the commercial standpoint, as I said prior, it has been significantly reduced over the past years.
When I was a kid growing up in Washington County, I went to school right near the canal, and we would see a lot of traffic. I mean, a lot of smaller tugboats and things of that nature. And we don't see them now. You're right. And I never realized that. But the recreational traffic is certainly there. And Meg, you mentioned again locks C8 and C9. And they're kind of right here in my wheelhouse. And they're actually on the canal itself. For folks that might not understand, the river, Hudson River, flows south. But the Gobi, we're worried about them coming north. But eventually the river splits off into the canal in Fort Edward. And from that point, it's, I don't know, maybe 20 miles or so to Lake Champlain, I'm going to guess. So if round goby were to get through C1, C2, and then they're making their way up, is there any kind of timeline how long it would take? Because I know they're going to be going upstream for a while, and then eventually they're going to be going downstream. And we discussed that before as well. Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, I mean, that is a million-dollar question at least right now that we do not have the answer to. So we have some data and information about how quickly round goby moved across the Erie Canal system from the Great Lakes to the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson Rivers. But the caveat there is that moving across the Erie Canal is sort of a traverse and a little bit uphill. And then around, you know, Rome, Utica area, it's more of a down stream fashion. So there's assistance of the juvenile stage of the round goby being able to, you know, float and move with currents as well as the adults. And once they get to the confluence, the Mohawk and the Hudson, they're really moving upstream. And it's very hard to know on the invasion front how quickly those organisms are going to be able to navigate moving upstream. We hope we have some time. You know, in our early detection monitoring program will hopefully help us answer those questions as to how much time. But the greatest current flow that they would move through would be between lock C1 and C7. And as you said, at lock C7, basically there is a land cut portion of the canal, which bridges the watershed divide between Lake Champlain and the Hudson. And so if they get into that section of the canal, it it has much less flow and it's much easier for organisms to move through that section of the canal. So really, if they got to lock C7, the timeline would be accelerated, I believe, if they got there.
There is a little data available in a canal's published rapid response plan that estimates the worst case scenario and a best case scenario. And if I recall the numbers correctly, worst case scenario is that it would take 3.8 years to go from C1 to C16, which is Whitehall.
C12, yep.
C12.
Yep.
The best case scenario is about 12 years. So as Meg alluded to, it's very fluid. If it was left to the Gobi themselves to swim that far, I would venture to say it's going to be on a 12-year. But more likely is the tag-along effect that you get from mechanical transportation and lock-throughs. So somewhere between 4 and 12 years, I think that's a very broad horizon. But it certainly gives you two relative senses of urgency, one to deal with a 4-year horizon completely different one to deal with a 12-year horizon. But they're still coming.
They're still coming. What does this mean for tributaries of Lake Champlain, the Winooski, the Pulteney, the Saranac, and the other, even the smaller streams that might have native brook trout or whatever. I mean, we keep talking about the salmon and the lake trout in Lake Champlain and the fact that the smallmouth and largemouth bass are going to flourish probably with these in there. But what does this mean for other bodies of water that are connected to Lake Champlain?
That is a good question. I mean, there is some research going on looking at, what kind of setting a baseline for understanding what kind of impacts goby might cause to tributaries coming into the Hudson from the recent invasion. We are concerned about displacement of the benthic fish species. Our darters and our sculpins would likely be outcompeted. It is a bit unclear, exactly what those impacts to the tributaries would be. We do talk a lot about the lake trout and the salmon, and that's primarily because a lot of people come to Lake Champlain for the bass and for the salmonid fishery. And while bass may do great eating goby and getting bigger and fatter at the beginning, goby have been observed to eat the eggs off of the bass nests. And in the time that it takes to take a bass into your boat and take your picture, unhook it, and throw it back in the water, the gobies will have eaten all the eggs that the males may be trying to protect on the nest. So we have seen in the state of Ohio changes in bass fishing seasons related to goby predation on bass nests. I would say that the bass impacts may be in the short term, bigger bass, and in the long term could threaten bass fishery in the lake. And the other big thing right now, which is a huge success story for Lake Champlain, is that we are seeing natural recruitment, so reproduction and increase in age class of naturally occurring lake trout, not stocked lake trout. And the way we know that is we clip the fins of all the lake trout that are stocked in the lake. And when the state agencies are going out and doing their sampling and their surveying, they were reporting a huge increase in the number of wild reproduction of lake trout. And they have reduced the stocking by 50% of lake trout in Lake Champlain. And we are on track to maybe have a naturally reproducing lake trout population. Round goby love to hang out in those little crevices in between the rocks where those lake trout like to lay their eggs and would be a direct threat to this natural reproduction of lake trout in the lake. And that's why I think we talk about that so much. But we are really worried about the loss of biodiversity at the base of the food web and what those cascading effects may have up the food web. We're also concerned about changing the angler experience. Many people are very familiar that in round goby infested waters, when they go angling, all they're catching is goby until, you know, the seventh or eighth hit. They might get a different fish that they're trying to fish for because they're such aggressive bait stealers. So they eat the eggs. And then another issue is they have been known to carry viral hemorrhagic septicemia, which is a fish disease that can affect over 25 different species of native freshwater fish in Lake Champlain. And it's the whole reason why we had the emergency bait fish regulations go into effect in the late 2000s. We still have not detected VHS in Lake Champlain, and we are actively testing populations of round goby on the invasion fronts, both below Lock C1 at the confluence of the Mohawk and the Hudson, and also in the St. Lawrence River in Quebec near the Richelieu River to see if those populations are carrying viral hemorrhagic septicemia.
Any concerns, I guess this would be trickle down, with other species such as waterfowl and or, you know, just birds, anything else that that thrives in the environment and the habitat that Lake Champlain provides? Could the goby and their impact on whatever species they impact, that in turn impacts these species? Has there been any discussion of that?
I would say less. We just don't know, honestly, how it's going to impact waterfowl populations. There is a threat, as been observed in the Great Lakes. Round goby do like to eat zebra mussels. They could never eat enough zebra mussels to impact the population in Lake Champlain. But there is the zebra mussels filter a lot of water and create an environment where certain types of botulism can grow. And if they concentrate it in the zebra mussels and the goby eat the zebra mussels and then the waterfowl eat the goby, we can have these die-offs of waterfowl that have been observed in the Great Lakes. And that is directly related to the interaction between the invasive zebra mussel and quagga mussel and the invasive round goby in that food chain. Those of an abundance of goby will be available for waterfowl. And that could be something that is that could occur in Lake Champlain, but we don't know, and we really don't want to find out.
We just reported in New York Outdoor News about, especially with Ed, about the fact they're not happy with what's being done right now. And can you shed some light on that, Ed? The current actions?
Well, the current actions, admittedly, their canals and DEC are limited with respect to what they can do today and tomorrow. I think the fact that they've expanded the double flushing is evidence of concern. However, there does exist a question of the efficacy of the double flushing, which Meg alluded to. And it's just that despite the fact that there is a lot of online information with respect to the goby, the threat the goby presents, the user groups, and I'm primarily referring to the angling community, we don't go looking for information if we aren't aware of the information. A lot of people I talk to in the angling community aren't aware of the goby. And when we talk about it, they say, well, where am I going to find out about this? And the people just don't go to the internet looking for problems. My concern is it's not being well publicized in the user groups where it should be. And once those user groups become aware of it, they become concerned and they're asking what's being done. And in a lot of cases, the what's being done doesn't seem to be enough. There's a lot of talk, but everybody's wary of talk, and quite honestly, the bureaucracy of regulatory agencies and government and how fast they're capable of moving. And that's my concern, is that we lose sight of this. We've seen the invasion of the spiny water flea and the fishhook water flea in particular in Lake Champlain in the last couple of years. And they're a real impediment to fishing deep water species trolling in the summer. I quit fishing on Lake Champlain in the warm water periods because the fleas are just too annoying, grabbing on your line and getting stuck in your eyelet. So the goby is today's burning platform. But to Meg's point about an all-taxes solution, you know, if the goby gets there, what's next? And we have to look forward in anticipation of what's next while dealing with what we have on our plate right now. So overall, it's my concern about the sense of urgency and the rate of which the issue is being addressed in more tangible means.
One final question, unless you have something else you'd like to discuss. What can anglers do? What can the public do? I mean, what can I do? What can you do to help the situation?
Well, as far as anglers, I mean, it's the same old thing that we're looking at now with the boat cleaning stations on Lake George and on the North Way and in selected spots on Lake Shannon. Clean, drain, dry. Make sure that you don't transport fish in your bait bucket or your live wells or your wet wells. There is nothing wrong with cleaning out the bilge of your boat with a little Clorox. That addresses not only the animal species, but the plant species. The anglers are responsible for a lot of the ills of the lake. We have to recognize that we are responsible for it. But at the same time, you know, the awareness, making sure that the angling community and anglers in general, we don't act unified as a unified group. We all complain to each other, but not to the people who count. Whatever you can do to bring this topic up layers within your community, within your town supervisors, there is some awareness in Saratoga County amongst the supervisors, but don't be shy about talking about it. Don't be shy about acting on it. Everybody has to contribute to this solution. We just can't depend on canals and DEC.
Meg, anything you'd like to add to that or anything you'd like to discuss that we didn't bring up in while we've been talking here today?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just say that, you know, we're very committed to working with all different types of users. There are different pathways by which aquatic invasive species can move across the landscape, and most of them are assisted by humans. So that is why we have invested a lot of resources into watercraft inspection and decontamination. So being courteous and polite to stewards who are on the launches, who are trying to help all different types of users of our water bodies do the right thing to make sure that they're clean, drained, and dry. That'll prevent overland introduction on watercraft, trailers, and other recreational equipment. That does not exclude, and important to remember, anchor lines and other equipment that comes into contact with the water. Following bait fish regulations and making sure we're not moving things around, as Ed referred to, is really important. And we do have man-made systems like canals that do connect watersheds that would otherwise not be connected. And so addressing these pathways and making sure that we are preventing the species from moving across the watersheds and allowing the users to continue to use the system is very positive. But another thing that really I think the angling and the boating community can contribute is they are out and on the water, and you are the eyes and ears of the water and can really report if you see something different, collect a sample of a verbal report is, you know, interesting, but not as helpful as a physical sample. If you think you see something different, learn how to identify the invasive versus the native, so the round goby versus the sculpin, and report it to the state agency so that we can help track the spread of these invasive species and react as quickly as we are capable of.
Fantastic. I want to thank you both for coming on today. It's been a pleasure having you, and perhaps we can catch up on this again down the road. It's something we're certainly monitoring, and I guess we will be for quite some time. You've been listening to the Great Northeast Podcast. For New York Outdoor News, I'm Dan Ladd.
Missed a past episode of the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast? You can find previous programs at outdoornews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platform. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover on this program, get yourself a subscription to Outdoor News. Simply call 800-535-5191 or visit us at outdoornews.com. And don't forget to join us again here in 2 weeks to talk everything out of doors. Thanks for listening to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast.